This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight,
South Sudan's rebel leader Riek Machar finally returned to Juba Tuesday to take his place as the country's vice president. But analysts warn that distrust and rivalry between the government and rebels could undermine the next phase of the transition.
That's Jill Craig, good reporting from Nairobi. Details coming up. Also, a world piracy watchdog says attacks by sea bandits is on the decline, but warned of continuing violence against ships off West Africa. And Nigerian media reports of military progress against the Boko Haram terrorist group. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour: the Associated Press reports that Cape Verde police have captured a soldier suspected of killing 11 people yesterday at a military installation. Local media identify him as 23-year-old Antonio Silva Ribeiro. He was captured in the capital following a 24-hour manhunt. Ribeiro is suspected of killing 8 soldiers and 3 civilians in Sodemingush. The government says he had personal reasons for launching the attack. It emphasized there was no attempted coup and no connection to illegal drugs. 2 days of national mourning began today. South Sudan rebel leader Riek Machar finally returned to Juba yesterday to take his place as the country's first vice president. But analysts warn that distrust between the government and rebels could undermine the next phase of the transition. Jill Craig reports from Nairobi.
Receiving a jubilant welcome at Juba International Airport Tuesday, rebel leader Riek Machar returned home to become vice president and create a new unity government with President Salva Kiir. And Gotwich Wall says it was a day of celebration.
Yeah, people are very, very happy. People are very happy, Lord. Traditional dancers, dancing inside, it was very, very wonderful. Elders, women and children have come out in huge numbers.
Wall is a South Sudanese lawyer living at an internally displaced persons camp within a UN base in Juba, where about 28,000 civilians have taken refuge. In all, the conflict has displaced over 2 million people. The problem is one of many resulting from the civil war that kicked off in December 2013, prompting Machar to leave Juba in the first place. Casey Copeland is a senior analyst at the International Crisis Group.
So Machar's return represents probably the most significant step so far in implementing the peace agreement that was signed in August 2015, but it is only one step. Following this, we will see the formation of the transitional government potentially within the next 24 hours, and that will give us a real sign of where things are going, to see who the government and who the opposition appoint to the various positions that they have.
The last time Machar was Kiir's vice president, it ended in civil war. In July 2013, President Kiir, a Dinka, fired Machar, an ethnic Nuer. Kiir said Machar was plotting a coup. Machar responded by announcing he would run for the presidency. Fighting began in Juba in December 2013 between Nuer and Dinka soldiers, quickly setting off violence throughout the country. Machar's return to Juba was delayed by months, and then by an additional week of tense last-minute wrangling over the number of troops and the weaponry he could bring. John Hirsch is a policy analyst at the Enough Project, a Washington-based atrocity prevention policy group.
I think that there was a real setback with the kind of back and forth between the opposition and the government last week over trading accusations about whose fault this was and why it hadn't happened yet, and, you know, just kind of fostering concerns of mistrust between the two parties.
The two sides finally reached an agreement amid pressure from the international community. Samantha Power, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, acknowledged the challenges ahead.
But everyone is clear-eyed. The difficulties that emerged in orchestrating Riek Machar's return to Juba are symptomatic of the larger climate of mistrust, all of the bloodshed that has occurred.
Brookings Institution senior fellow John Mbaku agrees.
So if they continue to fight for power, then nothing is going to change in South Sudan. Conditions will continue to deteriorate.
In his speech at Machar's inauguration Tuesday, Kiir apologized to the people of South Sudan for what he called the situation we the leaders have created. His words have led many to hope that this is a fresh start. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
In related news, the United States has announced it's giving additional aid to South Sudan to help those affected by conflict. The State Department says more than $86 million will be used to provide safe drinking water and sanitation, emergency health care, nutrition service, shelter, and agricultural assistance. The U.S. is the largest donor of humanitarian aid to South Sudan, giving more than $1.5 billion since December 23rd. When the civil war began. Migrants and refugees in Greece staged two protests yesterday over camp conditions and the detention of children. While at the makeshift camp at Idomeni on the Macedonian border, authorities are still trying to get 11,000 migrants to leave. Reporter Mariana Karakulaki in Idomeni, she spoke to VOA's Jody Kapawas first about yesterday's protests.
On the mainland, there was a protest in a camp called Hersos. It's quite close to Idomeni. The refugees who are living there sent out every organization that is inside, for example, the UNHCR and volunteers and everyone, and they locked themselves in. Probably because they are protesting the conditions of these camps, because Hersos is quite horrible. It's not a camp that can sustain people and people cannot stay there. It's pretty awful. Then there was a protest in Lesbos. From what I've seen on the Greek media, it was quite violent in the sense that there were some fires inside the camp. It was mainly children that they were protesting because children are also being detained. They are in prison.
Why are they being detained? Are they being considered for asylum status?
Basically, now every person that arrives in the Greek islands is being detained. Some of them can apply for asylum, others cannot. But until their asylum application is considered, they're in these camps as basically prisoners.
Now, I understand that the operation to return the migrants back to Turkey continues, but very few migrants are actually going back.
Yeah, it's quite slow. Maybe a group goes back every week, but it's not very certain because it doesn't make the news every day. Yesterday, there were some returns, and I've also heard rumors that some Syrians were also returned. I don't know if they went there voluntarily or if they were sent back by the authorities.
Now, Greek police are handing out pamphlets in the makeshift camp in Idomeni, hoping that the refugees and migrants will read it and be encouraged to go to other centers around the country. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, they started giving out these pamphlets yesterday. I met people that had pamphlets from yesterday and from today. It was the same thing. They gave similar pamphlets in Athens, in Piraeus as well. The language of this pamphlet in Idomeni is quite aggressive. The one that they gave in Piraeus was colorful. It had language like, we love you and we want you to stay here, but you need to go to the camps for your application to be considered. Here it's only an A4 paper, and it says you need to respect the regulations and you need to leave Idomeni because Idomeni was a transit camp, but it's not our fault that you're being stuck here in Greece. So go to the camps around Greece and your application will be considered. And I spoke to some refugees as well. They told me that every time that they go to the UNHCR to ask for information, the only thing that they tell them is, go to the camps and we will answer your questions there.
What are conditions like generally in these camps, and what are the conditions like in the makeshift camp at Idomeni, where I think there are some 11,000 people?
I haven't been to the camps because journalists are not allowed to go in without a permission, but I have met quite a few Syrians that are already in the camps. What they told me is that only one camp is quite nice, but the others are pretty awful. For example, there is one camp called Alexandria. It's near Idomeni. And refugees say that snakes every day, like 7 snakes in 2 days or so. So it's pretty dangerous. And actually, some of them told me that Idomeni is like a 5-star hotel compared to that camp. So they go to these camps and they come back to Idomeni because the conditions apparently here are better.
That's reporter Mariana Karakulaki from the Greek town of Idomeni. She spoke to VOA's Jody Capua. Today, Greece returned 12 Syrian refugees to Turkey, including a woman and her four children. The AP reports they were flown from the island of Lesbos to Adana in Turkey. So far, less than 400 migrants and refugees have been returned under last month's agreement between the EU and Turkey. There are some 54,000 migrants and refugees stranded in Greece who are not subject to the return policy. They arrived in Greece prior to the deportation agreement. However, European nations have closed their borders to them. A main suspect in November's Paris terrorist attacks, Salah Abdeslam, appeared in a French courtroom today, soon after being hastily handed over by Belgian authorities. Abdeslam's lawyer, Frank Berton, said his client is anxious to cooperate with authorities. Abdeslam is to be placed in isolation in a Paris area prison. He was the only alleged attacker who survived the Paris attacks and could be a vital participant in helping authorities piece together the events of the November 13th attacks on several Paris locations that killed 130 people. Nigeria media report military progress against the Boko Haram terrorist group. The Daily Guardian newspaper says the army has found new uniforms and other means of identification worn by some members of the group. An army spokesman says that earlier this week, troops encountered insurgents in the Nagla local government area of Borno State. The rebels were wearing new uniforms made of green material with rope attached to their legs and neck. The army apprehended two Boko Haram members, as well as five motorcycles, weapons, a solar panel, and two bags of food. In other news on Nigeria, the Lagos Daily Post online reports an Islamic organization wants some Fulani herdsmen designated as terrorists for recent attacks against farmers. The group Muslims Against Terror says it wants the full power of the military to be used against those involved in attacks. Some Fulani have been blamed for killing farmers in Benue, Enugu, Delta, and Anambra states. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. A world piracy watchdog says overall attacks by sea bandits is on the decline, but it warns of continuing raids on ships off West Africa. The London-based International Maritime Bureau says globally there have been 37 attacks by pirates so far this year. That compares to 54 attacks during the same period last year. But the Bureau says since January there have been 10 attacks in the Gulf of Guinea, usually involving the theft of fuel oil. 44 crew members were abducted in those attacks. In comparison, in Southwest Asia, there have been 6 attacks on ships so far this year, compared to 30 in the first few months of 2015. The Bureau credits the actions of authorities in Malaysia and Indonesia for the decline. There's a new obstacle in Libya to having the UN-backed Government of National Accord, or GNA, replace two rival governments. The former internationally recognized regime in Tobruk has announced it's selling oil through its own National Oil Corporation. This would be in competition to the oil corporation operated by the rival government in Tripoli. No word yet on how the international community will respond. Meanwhile, the Tripoli-based government continues to refuse to recognize the Government of National Accord. VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi asked its foreign minister, Ali Abu Zakouk, about the refusal to accept the GNA.
The reason was from the very beginning that the political agreement, which was signed in Skhirat, there was questions about the validity of the signees there and their representation of the Libyan institutions. Because even those members from the GNC and from the House of Representatives, they signed without giving permission from their institutions to sign for them. So the situation is that there is a political agreement signed by a number of Libyans. Most of them do not have the mandate from the Libyan people. But the reality is that the world community at large wanted to recognize it and wanted to make it a de facto government in Libya.
Do you expect the government of National Accord, which took over the Libyan ministries, to get the long-awaited vote of confidence from the House of Representatives?
Well, first of all, it is still, according to the political agreement, a project of a government. It has not been confirmed and given the vote of confidence as a government. But the government of National Salvation in Tripoli decided that there is no need to confront them by all means, and they wanted to let the process go as it goes. And the House of Representatives have not yet ratified the agreement or ratified the new government. So they are in limbo in reality, even though they have taken some of the ministries over there, and they are continuing to do the same thing in the rest of Tripoli, in the capital of Libya.
With the apparent political division in Libya, how would you see a way out?
There are two views of this, either the logical constitutional view or the de facto view. There seems to be the de facto view is taking the upper hand, because the United Nations, the United States, the European Community and the Arab League and everybody is just wanting to get rid of the Libyan issue without discussing the validity of the situation. So they are taking side by the project of the government of National Accord. I personally don't seem to have much hope, even though I consider the situation to be calmer in Tripoli than it is in my city, Benghazi, which has been decimated by criminal loyal of Gaddafi's army before. And unfortunately, he is the one who is really making it hard for the House of Representatives to even discuss the government of National Accord and to give it ratification.
So would the next pressure from the international community focus on General Haftar now?
Well, General Haftar should be considered war criminal by the acts he has done in the country. And at the same time, what shall the world community do vis-a-vis the House of Representatives and their ally, Colonel Haftar?
Final question. Libyans reject any foreign interference in Libya. What could the international community do to help restore stability in Libya and get rid of Daesh?
I think the Libyans have shown that if they were given the opportunity, they can get rid of Daesh. They have got rid of Daesh in Derna. And it is so amazing that when the Daesh fled from Derna and went through the checkpoints of Karama army of Haftar, they have let them go. They have not fought them, despite the claims that they are fighting Daesh. The other one is that in Sabratha, also the Libyan Revolutionary Forces were able to eradicate Daesh. The main center of Daesh is still now in Sirte, where it has been supported by the remnants of the former regime. One will question the role of Colonel Haftar in the relationship with Daesh, because even Jadran, who has controlled the oil ports in Sidra Gulf, has said that Daesh and Haftar are two sides of one coin.
And that was Ali Abu Zakouk, a foreign minister of Libya's Tripoli-based government. He spoke to VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi. Being a journalist can get you jailed or even killed in many countries. Two new reports say the media is facing great pressure and more danger than any time in the past. The reports have been released ahead of the UN Press Freedom Day next Tuesday. As VOA's Jeffrey Young reports, women journalists in particular are facing great challenges.
Two new reports from the NGOs Freedom House and the Committee to Protect Journalists say reporters are increasingly threatened by physical danger,
harsh anti-press laws or by force in many countries to avoid challenging governments or radical movements. The Freedom House report, titled The Battle for the Dominant Message, says news agencies presenting balanced reporting face stiff competition from other media outlets designed specifically to promote a political or radical religious agenda. It says the media environment in a growing number of countries is characterized by partisanship and polarization. The CPJ report, titled Attacks on the Press, spotlights the additional challenge a reporter faces if she is a woman. Here's CPJ's Dr. Courtney Redge.
Women face specific threats, specific types of violence, which is often sexualized, and they face this type of violence both offline in the physical world, sexual assaults, discrimination at work, difficulty in getting assignments, and they face this online through trolling, sexualized harassment online.
North Korea tops Freedom House's 2015 Not Free list. Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan are second and third. Eritrea is fifth, and Equatorial Guinea eighth. More journalists are being killed. The CPJ reports 10 journalists have died since the beginning of this year, and these victims are not only war correspondents. Freedom House says writing about corruption, organized crime, religion, and environmental or land development issues can get reporters arrested or harmed. Syria led the world last year in the number of journalists killed, with 14. The Charlie Hebdo massacre of 8 cartoonists and editors in Paris pushed France into the number 2 spot. The East African state of Eritrea is rated the most censored country. North Korea and Saudi Arabia are second and third, with Ethiopia fourth. CPJ's Courtney Reds.
So Eritrea and Ethiopia top the list because they have the most journalists in prison out of all countries in Africa. They restrict the internet. They have limited independent press. In fact, essentially no press.
The rest of the top 10 most censored list include Azerbaijan, Vietnam, Iran, China, Myanmar, Burma, and Cuba. China has the dubious honor of having the most journalists behind bars. Sub-Saharan Africa presented a mixed picture in 2015. On the bright side, Burkina Faso decriminalized libel. Ivory Coast's private media market expanded, and there were fewer attacks on those outlets. Togo opened up its media to opposition candidates in 2015, but at the same time, reintroduced prison terms for disseminating what authorities call false news. On the negative side, Freedom House says Ghana, previously the only country in Africa deemed free for media, dropped to partly free. In Burundi, last May's political crisis resulted in the shutdown of nearly all independent media. Kenya increased media pressure through new repressive laws and other intimidation. In Tanzania, two new laws strengthen restrictions on reporters. Freedom House's report lists 9 countries to watch in 2016. 3 are in Africa. In Egypt, we may be seeing the emergence of more critical reporting, but there are also indications of increasing moves by the state to enforce conformity. Zimbabwe is being monitored as the ruling party sorts out the question of who will succeed President Robert Mugabe. And Ghana appears to be increasing pressure on media in advance of elections later this year. Jeffrey Young, VOA News.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Chaka Sali, coming up at 18:30 UTC. I'm Hayes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Aidan Utku, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss the politics of South Sudan, reconciling and uniting the nation. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa, next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.